south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
You know, I don't think I mentioned this before, but about 500 shows ago, maybe even more, I got a couple of emails from people saying, Johnny, you're going to run out of things to talk about. There's only so much you can say about living in Latin America, and sooner or later you're going to start repeating yourself, so you might as well quit while you're ahead. Well, let me tell you, it did not work out that way. In fact, if you look at the stacks of notes and articles and emails and videos I have sitting here right in front of me right now at my desk, man, if aliens vaporized all of Latin America tomorrow, I'd have another 500 shows worth of material. So if you're wondering if I'm ever going to run out of material, well, I will when I finally kick the bucket or Alzheimer's kicks in. Whatever comes first. Though, my dear old strict German mom's 92 years old now, and she's still driving around and teaching one day a week at the university in Chicago. She does that to keep her insurance, you know. And believe it or not, her 10 brothers and sisters, all except one who croaked, did it in their 90s. And the rest of them who are in their 80s and 90s now are out and about doing what she's doing. And really, out of the 11 brothers and sisters in that family, only one died young. He was about 22. Got in a terrible car accident, concussion, in a coma for a long time, and then died of a brain tumor. Now, of course, on my dad's side, he croaked at 54, but he had one of the worst piece of crap diets I ever saw. Of course, back in the 80s, when he finally did get that heart attack, people thought it was fat that killed you, when all along it was sugar. And man, was he addicted to sugar. But back in the 70s and 80s, who knew? The thing is, everyone on my mother's side were big-time farmers, so they ate nothing but homegrown, home-raised produce, meat, etc. Whereas my father was a city boy who loved his soda pop and candy bars. In fact, I remember as a kid, he used to keep a case of cold Diet Pepsi in the fridge at all times. Man, he was addicted to that stuff too, and it was pure poison. Oh, and I remember he was addicted to Tums too. Remember those things, Tums? Because he constantly, as he said, had, quote, acid reflux. So anyway, I've got my mother's farmer genes going for me, but who knows? By the way, speaking of 500 plus shows ago, let's go back even more to the very beginning of this show, The Expat Files Living in Latin America. Now, you might find this hard to believe, but there were people writing me emails 10, 11 years ago in the very beginning, talking about how they absolutely had to get out of Dodge. They had to have a plan B. They saw the warning signs, the writing on the wall. Things were falling apart. They wanted out. They were getting their plan B going. So then why should I mention that? Well, because many of those same people, this goes back 10, 11, 12 years even, have been writing me emails continuously all along. Some every couple of months, sometimes every couple of weeks, but they continue to write. I'm talking dozens and dozens of them who are still writing me 10, 11 years later, and they're still sitting in Newark, Detroit, Cleveland, Milwaukee, talking about getting the hell out of Dodge. Yet they seem to have put no energy into it at all except the lip flapping. Oh, they keep harping about how bad it is. They keep talking about how they're going to get that plan B going and get the hell off the Titanic. But they just don't pull the trigger. So the point is, I realized a long, long time ago, there are tons and tons of tire kickers listening to this show. People on the fence, people who want out in a big way, but they're never really going to do it. Though I have to admit, when it comes to my Expat Insider Seminar, most of them are really motivated, though they might not pack their bags and jump ship when they're down here or when they immediately get back to the States. But 6 months, a year, 2 years down the line, I often get that email that says, Johnny, I've tied up all my loose ends. I'm coming on down this September or November, whatever. Funny thing is, though, talking about people who have been on the fence for 10 years or so, you know, the guys and gals I expect will never make the leap. They keep sending me emails asking me really good and pertinent questions about expatting. And many times I send them a couple of my free reports or reply with a nice, concise answer, or sometimes I read their email on the show, fully knowing they're perpetual tire kickers and will probably never come down. I'm not clairvoyant, but I can spot these guys and gals a mile away. They've been shooting me emails off and on for years. I've sent them lots of reports, replied personally to many of them. Yet in all that time, they've never really got any meaningful boots on the ground off the gringo tourist trail. Because, you know, if you go to Tijuana, Costa Rica, Cancun, Tulum, Playa del Carmen, etc., that doesn't really count as boots on the ground, not to me. How can you see the real Latin America when you're coddled in a gringo tourism bubble? So, on that note, I'd like to talk about another phenomena that seems to happen mostly with people on a very, very low or limited budget. They don't have a lot of dough, so the first place they land in Latin America is the one they fall in love with. It usually happens to people in college or in their 20s, when they land in that very first Latin American destination. By the way, I'm not talking about U.S.-Mexican border towns like Tijuana. That's a first impression. So if you're not landing in one of those border towns, it makes a huge imprint because it's such a pleasant culture shock. And when you're back in the States or Europe, whatever, you decide that's going to be your plan B. That's the place you're going to end up living. And Costa Rica is probably the best example of all, because up till about 10 years ago anyway, Costa Rica was one of the prime first stop Latin American destinations for backpackers and people on a low, low budget. Of course, now it's first world expensive, but backpackers really don't care because they'll always be able to find a $10 a night cold water flea bag hotel with 10 beds and one bathroom. The difference is, early on, 30 years ago, when I first landed there, the gringos had landed all right, but the gringo pricing hadn't really kicked in. So what am I getting at? Well, bear with me for a second. What I'm talking about is a kind of a narrow tunnel vision I see quite frequently when people first land in Latin America in a place like Costa Rica or anywhere on the tourist trail. They fall in love with the place, but they really never get any experience or boots on the ground in what you might call the real Latin America. Hey, it happened to me. Costa Rica was my first destination, and I fell in love with the place too. But man, looking back, it was like going into a Baskin-Robbins 57 flavors and picking vanilla. And on that note, and this might sound way off topic, but I'd like to read a few excerpts for you from a letter that came to me by hook and crook from a person who left the United Kingdom because of the terrible problems they're having there with Muslim immigrants. Now, this letter, which is obviously very un-PC, what else is new? Goes a long way to explain why so many Europeans are moving to Latin America. Now, as for me, I'm not a casual observer as to the radical Muslim invasion that's happening in Western Europe right now. I've seen it for myself. I used to live in England, did my useless MBA there. And many years ago, I lived half a year on the Italian Mediterranean coast near Portofino. And I make periodic trips to one of my favorite cities in Europe, Barcelona, which is also being invaded by Muslims. By the way, have you been paying attention to the news out of Europe? The fact that there are neighborhoods in Italy, France, Spain, and England. Muslim neighborhoods where the police won't even go. So let me read you a couple excerpts from this letter from a British guy. He's no dummy. He's got a PhD in philosophy. No wonder he's a self-professed cheapskate and perpetually broke. Anyway, he calls himself a self-imposed exile as Britain begins to change from a free country to quite the opposite. His words. He starts out by saying, and I'll paraphrase this, I flew from London to Costa Rica in 2016 and forgot to go home. What began as an extended holiday, however, gradually turned into a self-imposed exile as Britain begins to change from a free country to quite the opposite. He says, Costa Rica is not an easy country to migrate to, though you can if you're a pensionado and receive a certain amount of money per month. Similarly, if your income from outside Costa Rica is sufficient, or you marry a Tica or Tico, Costa Rican's name for themselves, the same applies. Otherwise, you cannot legally earn money as a non-resident, though that's often circumvented. He says if you're not a resident, you're obliged to leave the country every 90 days for a period of 72 hours at least. However, in practice, it's possible to sit in a bar just over the Panama border for an hour or two and go straight back. This is known as perpetual tourism and is one of the many gray areas in Costa Rica and the rest of Latin America. Then, he says, you will be asked on returning to Costa Rica for proof of an onward travel ticket. A bus ticket often suffices. And you have to prove validation of at least $300 flowing into your bank account for every month of your stay. Not easy documentation to produce. And you must supply a real permanent address where you're staying. And though pre-COVID, a year and a half ago or so, those regulations were rarely enforced completely. There were workarounds. Now you must not only have those, but health insurance for 90 days, which costs a little over $300 or $100 a month for the 90-day stay. And me, being a non-resident, he says, I used to go to Panama after 90 days. Unfortunately, I missed a visa stamp just once, and now I'm barred from re-entering Panama unless I pay a $1,000 fine. I admit, it was entirely my fault. And the lesson is always to check your visa stamps and do the calculations before you head to the border. Now I just go to Nicaragua and stay the 7 2 hours. Hmm. All right, me, Johnny, here. He says he does it in a town in Nicaragua called San Carlos by the beautiful and vast Lake Managua. Yep, that's what he calls it. The beautiful, vast Lake Managua. All positive. He doesn't say a single negative thing about it. Sounds like a travel agency brochure. Well, to me, that shows how much he knows about Nicaragua, because Lake Managua is one of the most polluted lakes in the entire world. And though it may be beautiful, like he says, I'd never want to live on it, drink from it, swim in it, or eat a fish that's been living in it. But that's just me. All right, now a little aside, but it'll bring us right back. Remember earlier I was talking about backpackers and gringos and expats living on extremely tight budgets? Well, listen to this. He says, when my savings began to run out in 2017, I became a hobbyist musician playing guitar and singing in restaurants, supplying enough income to make a go of it here, at least temporarily. All right, me, Johnny, here again. Man, you just don't know how many thousands and thousands of gringos, expats, Europeans, etc., who run out of money but love Latin America. So they find their niche working for nickels and dimes, free meals, and free lodging. Whether it's singing at hole-in-the-wall bars and restaurants, making and hawking jewelry on the street, or maybe it's waiting tables and holding down the front desk at a mom-and-pop hotel. All completely off the books, of course, because you're not supposed to be able to work unless you've got your residency. And almost none of these backpackers and very low-budget types have their residency because they can't meet the outside income requirements. So then he says the present problem is COVID. Working for cash is in the decline, as many restaurants aren't open or require a factura electronica, online receipt requiring resident status for workers and a legal registered on the books business to work at. All right, me, Johnny, again. Remember, he's talking about Costa Rica now, where long, long ago, even 30 years ago, the locals had a hotline number you could call if you suspected a gringo or expat was working off the books in a restaurant or wherever. Yep, they'd report you in a second because, you know, they're taking jobs from the locals, right? Even though most times that wasn't the case at all. To me, it just seemed like revenge tactics and the general begrudging of wealthy gringos invading their country and kind of taking over everything, which is pretty much exactly what they did. The gringo invasion, of course, happened in Costa Rica and various cities in Mexico and Panama first. So they're the ones now who have the tightest rules on expat off-the-books employment. And if they catch you, they'll throw the book at you and bar you from entering the country again. Yep, as you can imagine, the locals, especially the poor and middle-class locals, just hate to see gringos and expats making money in their country, especially if they or one of their family is out of work. Though I have to admit, I've never seen that attitude off the gringo tourist trail, only where the gringos have invaded. And in a way, you can see their point. How would you like it if in your little town in Nebraska or whatever, a bunch of Germans, Irish, French, Italians, Ukrainians, or even Vietnamese started piling into your country and kind of converting it into their idea of what it should be like? I'm sure you'd have some built-up resentment too. All right, then he says, and this is interesting, giving Britain's per capita mortality rate for COVID, it's certainly safer in Costa Rica and in more ways than one. He says, and these facts are wrong and pretty much stupid, but here they are. He says, as I write, the coronavirus has killed approximately 0.18% of the U.S. population and 0.19% of the U.K. population. Almost the same. Whereas in Costa Rica, the figure is 0.0009%. Apparently 100 times fewer deaths per capita in Costa Rica. All right, me, Johnny, here again. Those numbers, you know, are all bullshit. Because, you know, if anyone dies who tests positive, it's called COVID. You know the story. It's bullshit. Hell, if your dog or your pet ferret died and tested positive for COVID, they'd be COVIDiot death statistics, too. But we won't argue with the writer. Let him live in his panicky COVIDiot fantasy like 99% of the rest of the world. Though with new, disclosed cover-ups unfolding, all that's changing. Though he does bring up an interesting point about Costa Rica that I've never considered before, but it does make sense. He says Costa Rica's Ministry of Health, Ministerio de Salud, made early COVID moves which seem baffling and confusing unless you know certain things about Costa Rica. For example, they banned non-essential driving. All but emergency services and supply chain journeys were permitted. That was between 10 p.m. and 5 a.m. It seemed ridiculous until you realized that Costa Rica always appears in the top 5 list of fatal car accidents worldwide. So, we can make the claim, or maybe not, that the Minister of Health knew this, and his aim was to keep the country's 150 intensive care units free of the usual barrage of car crash victims, thus leaving the beds open for COVIDiot cases. Now, here's where this guy's letter gets racy. Remember, he's a PhD in philosophy, who's absolutely sick of his own country get invaded by Muslims. So here's what he says. He says, demographically, Costa Rica is absolutely to my liking. Wikipedia says 84% of the population is white or mestizo, although Native and European mixed blood populations are far less than other Latin American countries. In other words, a very small percentage of their population is indigenous. He says there are a few, about 1.1% blacks in Costa Rica, almost all on the east coast of the Caribbean. But there is really no trace of ghettos, no jeans worn at half-mast or aggressive street swagger either. And then he says, as for Muslims, there are between 1,500 and 5,000 in a country of 5 million. I have only met two personally, a property owner and the owner of the biggest hotel in town. I doubt, he says, they own a Quran between them. And then he says, and I didn't know this either, Costa Rica was requested by the UN to take 5,000 Syrian refugees. The Costa Rican government politely declined. The official government response was that this is a Catholic country and Muslims wouldn't like it here. In fact, Costa Rica's President Solis was quoted as saying, quote, I don't want a humanitarian gesture to end up with us building ghettos in Costa Rica. We don't want that. No quiero construir ghettos, dices Solis, sobre la posibilidad de recibir refugiados. That very un-PC quote was seen in the Costa Rican media and newspapers on September 11, 2015. And get this, in the capital, San Jose, when Muslims asked the municipality or local authority for permission to build a mosque, they too were calmly turned down. Now imagine a government municipality refusing to do that in Portland, Berlin, or Paris. There'd be worldwide outrage. Then he says, Costa Rica, compared with how the police do things in Britain, where authorities have turned a blind eye to decades of Muslim grooming gangs. Though British cops will zealously pursue anyone who dares to tweet something truthful but anti-Muslim, meanwhile, the Costa Rican police actually do real policing. Then he says, provided you keep your nose clean in Costa Rica, it feels safer here than in London. Now remember, as you've heard, this guy is a very Spartan guy, lives on very little money, and he's living pretty much like what we call white trash in the States. And the proof of it is, he says his two-bedroom apartment, including electricity, is $200 a month. Now, I have many friends and acquaintances in Costa Rica, and you can't get a two-bedroom apartment and live like a first-world person in a good neighborhood for under $1,000 a month. It's almost impossible. Now, you longtime listeners have heard me say I lived in Costa Rica for almost 3 years, around 30 years ago. Even back then, a nice two-bedroom apartment in a decent neighborhood was $400 to $500 a month. So this guy is educated and smart as he is, has gone native. Hey, nothing wrong with that. But I'd be willing to wager 99% of you listeners out there would not enjoy living like that. So take his ideas and proclamations with a grain of salt or whatever. But the point is, as you can see from his case, it's not just conservative, upper middle class and wealthy people in Europe who are getting the hell out of Dodge. It's obvious. This guy who wrote this letter seems as liberal and left-wing as they come. But he, too, saw the writing on the wall and just had to escape. In fact, he says this, more than anything, this is not the UK I grew up in. It's a collection of counties rapidly becoming Soviet Union 2.0, but with marginally better department stores and dental care. He says it's genuinely dangerous in England to speak or write on certain topics, whereas in Costa Rica, the Constitution actually protects freedom of speech. Then, finally, he closes his letter by saying he believes there will come a time when there is a mass white flight from the U.S. and the U.K. to Costa Rica. All right, me, Johnny, here. I have to say, you got to admire the guy for being honest. He's got some balls because, let's face it, if anyone wrote that kind of a letter, blog or social media post, the Facebook and Twitter mob would destroy him. And if he had any kind of on-the-books job or teaching in his chosen career, philosophy, they would just chew him right up and spit him out. Good thing he's singing and bartending for a living, huh? Because, you know, being that he's in Costa Rica and doesn't have a so-called legitimate boss, he's not working for the man, he can say exactly what's on his mind. The thing is, though, you know, this guy's never lived anywhere else in Latin America except Costa Rica, and he just popped in and out of Panama and Nicaragua to maintain his tourist visa. So he's got tunnel vision, and he can only really speak of Costa Rica. But the truth is, around 17 of the 20 Latin American countries have the same strong freedom of speech rights. The only three countries they suppress freedom of speech are Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua. And you could say those three countries are already the Soviet Union 2.0. Oh, and by the way, if you think I'm a Muslim hater, no way. Over the years, I've had a lot of engineering buddies who came from the Middle East or Pakistan, and they're Muslims, but you never know it. They just didn't mention their religions. No Allah Akbar spiels or pressure at all. And that's the way it should be, whatever religion you are. But there is sort of a perpetual dilemma once you think about it. It's true, not all Muslims are terrorists, that's for sure. But on the other hand, there's never been a single case in history of a Christian strapped to a bomb, blowing up a restaurant, school bus, metro station, whatever, in the name of Jesus. All right, moving on. Remember last show, I was talking about Mexican billionaire Carlos Slim, who built that subway line 12 in Mexico City that collapsed and killed 26 people. Well, isn't it funny that he came out just yesterday saying he will repair the collapsed Mexico City metro line at no cost to the government? He says it'll reopen in a year, so it'll take him a year to fix what they should have done right in the first place. Oh, and I bet everyone in Mexico is so happy about that. He's trying to come off as the benevolent hero now. What a bad joke, huh? Couldn't do it right the first time. So after 26 deaths, he'll swoop in as the savior and fix it. Yep, his PR machine's working 24/7 to paint him as the hero instead of the fiend he really is. Oh well, but that's what happens to the too big to jail. Just like the banksters who got bailed out, who were to blame for that market blowout in 2008 that almost brought the entire system down, but no one went to jail, not one. Yeah, man, it's time to hit that reset button. But you really want to get out of Dodge before that happens. Things ain't pretty, but just wait. So whether you're a glass half empty or half full type of person, doesn't matter. If you're not making moves to get the hell out of Dodge now, you're in for a world of hurt. Unless you're part of the 0.1%. No, not the 1%. Remember, I mentioned in the last show, the 0.1% are loaded and can live anywhere. Whereas you enter the 1% worldwide when you hit $35,000 a year. In the States, $35,000 a year will make you a pauper. Down here in Latin America, you're upper middle class. But you knew that already, right? Oh, and just one more thing about Carlos Fatboy Slim. You know what he said in a news conference yesterday? Remember, an international inspection team of engineers from Norway came in and said Line 12 was riddled with defects. Bad welds, missing bolts, faulty girders. You remember. Yet on Tuesday, Carlos Fatboy Slim said, quote, "It was done by the best engineers in Mexico," he said. The best engineers in Mexico. Hey, I can laugh because, you know, in a past life, I was a real engineer. So allow me to say this about the engineers I've met here in Latin America, and I've met dozens and dozens of them. A few of them who I recognized right away were smarter than I was. But there's just one big problem, or two. Actually, there turns out to be a huge difference in the way engineers come into existence in the U.S. in the first world compared to Latin America, and most of the third world, too. And here's that first difference. In practically all Latin American professional schools, they teach you to memorize things. And there's a lot less hands-on laboratory work in Latin America because the engineering schools in Latin America don't have the kind of dough first world schools have to really outfit laboratories with that necessary, very expensive high-tech equipment. Now, the memorization part, well, there's lots of that in first world engineering schools and technical schools too, but it's not a huge part of your training. I mean, look, you have to memorize certain basic equations like Ohm's Law. You can't be looking up every common equation every time you're working on a project. Speaking of good old Ohm and his law, here's a story for you. In high school, I had a crush on a girl. Her name was Rita Ohm, O-H-M. Her great-great, and maybe you could add another great, grandfather was the oh-so-famous George Ohm. And man, she was a beautiful, smart, and hot girl. She was captain of the football team material, so I never had a chance with her. And then, about 6 or 7 years after high school graduation, I was a kind of established engineer myself, I ran into her at the dentist's office. I asked her what she'd been doing. She was a Playboy bunny at the Chicago Playboy Club. We got to talk, and I told her I had a little crush on her in high school. And she said, "Really? Why didn't you say something?" I thought, oh, well, that's the way the Kringle crumbles. But I digress, as usual. Anyway, down here in Latin America, even in the smartest Latino engineers I've ever met, there's something definitely missing. And what that is the hands-on experience you get when you're growing up that makes you decide to go into engineering in the first place. Like, for example, practically all the first world engineers I know, even when they were young kids, 10, 12 years old, were taking apart their mom's and dad's dishwashers, microwave ovens, vacuum cleaners, trash compactors, radios, TVs. Though admittedly, as I found out, there were many times I couldn't get the stuff back together again. But I did make a deal with my folks. When something broke around the house, I'd always say, before you call in the repair guy, let me have a crack at it. And sometimes it worked. The point is, if you grow up as an average kid in Latin America with the brains and the fortitude to become an engineer, there's close to a 100% chance you didn't have a car, vacuum, microwave oven, whatever, to take apart and dick around with. And almost no Latino engineer I've ever met has done a valve job or a brake job on his parents' car. Because when they were growing up, most of their parents did not have a car. And here's another thing. Engineers who were growing up in my era, we had Radio Shack, Heathkit, and electronics stores to hang around in. Those were a budding engineer's tinkering paradise. As for me, I built a guitar amplifier when I was 13 years old. It was a Heathkit. In the end, it was a piece of crap compared to a Fender or Marshall amp. But by the time I was 13 years old, I'd already built a guitar amplifier that actually worked. Whereas Latin American engineers had no such experiences when they were kids. They didn't have Radio Shack or Heathkit or TVs and stereo systems you could take apart and kind of dick around with and figure things out by yourself. Take Bitcoin Dan, one of the smartest engineers I know. You might think by talking to him he was a super nerd and never changed a light bulb, but man, Dan did overhauls on his dad's tractor because he lived on a farm. When he was just a kid, he worked on sump pumps and drainage systems. In other words, he had the kind of hands-on, make it and take it apart, maybe even break it, kind of childhood that most American engineers, born basically before the iPhone age, had in common, and that made you a really well-rounded engineer. Whereas in Latin America and up in the States just recently, probably the last generation, kids who go into the sciences and engineering never have a chance to take apart their dad's car or fiddle around with a broken TV or radio because everything's so damn disposable. Besides that, electronic equipment is no longer discrete. It's all modular, so if a card or circuit board blows, you change it. You're done. Whereas in the old days, TVs, radios, monitors, guitar amplifiers, etc. had discrete components in them. Transistors, diodes, integrated circuits. There were no circuit board cards to interchange. You had to test every discrete component along the signal path to figure out what went wrong or what blew out. Hey, I hope I'm not boring you too much with this rant. But I can tell you there's a good reason I'd rather be stuck on a desert island with an engineer who graduated engineering school before the millennia than anyone graduating from engineering school in the last 20 years. So bottom line, going back to that statement by fat boy Carlos Sim saying that that subway metro disaster was built and designed by the best engineers in Mexico, unquote. I just think, man, you probably shouldn't have said that. It's like what expat Eddie once said. Every curious, scientific, and nerdy guy would like to go into space, at least once for a short time anyway. What if someone offered you a free trip to space? Go around the Earth a couple times, a few orbits, and come right back. It's every little curious teenage kid's dream too, right? The only caveat being you'd have to travel in a 100% Mexican designed and built rocket. What? You say you'll pass? Or maybe you want to sleep on it. Now, why would you say that? Are you racist? You know Mexico's best will be in charge of the project. The guys who designed Metro Line 12, of course.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.